morning and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, September 17, 2014. The European Union adds its voice to the chorus calling on the two warring parties in South Sudan to end the fighting and assure access to aid delivery.
We expect the parties to abide to their commitments dating back to May to facilitate the operations of humanitarian organizations, to facilitate access and to ensure that indeed humanitarian aid is dispatched.
And one influential analyst critical of the government's new circular says South Sudan's economy depends on foreign transactions in the country.
If you were to withdraw some of these workers who are paid in dollars, of course, and they inject these dollars into the economy, if they were to withdraw, you would see a negative impact on the foreign exchange market.
We'll have this story and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The European Union Commission is urging South Sudan's warring parties to move swiftly to end the conflict and form a transitional government within 45 days' time period, as suggested last month by the regional bloc, the Intergovernmental Authority on Development. A senior EU official visiting South Sudan says no amount of humanitarian aid will prevent the suffering of South Sudanese people unless a deal is reached. For VOA News, Philip Thorn Aleu has more from Juba.
Luis de Branua, Operations Director at the EU Commission Humanitarian Aid and Civic Protection Department, says the humanitarian situation will worsen until the two parties stop fighting and tens of thousands of displaced people are able to return home. He says the EU has already donated a total of nearly 220 million euros to provide humanitarian aid to displaced South Sudanese this year alone. De Branua says the money has helped at least 2.4 million South Sudanese, but he says more money is not the answer.
Humanitarian aid is not the solution to the crisis. The solution must be a political one. We are hopeful that the ongoing process in Addis under IGAD leadership will be conducive to some kind of political settlement and political agreement, which would create the condition for a genuine reconstruction and rebuilding of this country.
De Branua says if both parties finally reach a deal, a looming permit could be evaded.
This is not a natural disaster. This is not a Sahel-type famine. This is a man-made disaster.
De Branua says both the government and rebel negotiators must seriously engage in the IGAD-mediated peace talks in Addis Ababa in order to end the conflict once and for all. Talks are due to resume this week in the Ethiopian capital. The two parties are supposed to agree on a transitional government of national unity by the end of this month, according to an ultimatum issued by IGAD in mid-August. De Branua says, aside from reaching agreement in Addis, the two warring parties must also ensure that international aid workers have unimpeded access to people in need of humanitarian assistance.
We expect the parties to abide to their commitments dating back to May to facilitate the operations of humanitarian organizations, to facilitate access and to ensure that indeed humanitarian aid is dispatched to whoever needs it, wherever in the country, independently and in a neutral way, independently from all kinds of criteria or consideration, and so on and so forth.
The United Nations says at least 10,000 people have died and nearly 2 million people have been uprooted from their homes since fighting began in mid-December. Humanitarian agencies have been warning of a looming famine by the end of this year, which will affect nearly half of the country's estimated population. South Sudan's population is estimated to be between 11.3 and 11.8 million, according to the World Population Review and the World Bank. Government officials insist the number of people at risk of famine is much lower, saying only 3 of the country's 10 states are affected by the conflict. For VOA News, I am Philip Tonaleu in Juba.
The government of South Sudan says a directive issued by the Ministry of Labor, which says Foreign nationals have to be fired from several positions and replaced with South Sudanese workers has been misunderstood. From Juba, Mungume Devs Rakarinj files this report.
South Sudan's Foreign Affairs Minister, Barnaba Mariar Benjamin, told reporters at a news conference today that the government is not going to expel foreigners who are working in the country.
Whether they are Ugandans or Kenyans or Ethiopians or Eritreans or Egyptians or whatever. So the government of South Sudan is not expelling any foreign workers in this country. We would like this statement to be very clear.
On Monday, the Labour Ministry published a directive in newspapers in Juba ordering NGOs and private health businesses to fire foreign workers in specific jobs. Those jobs included top management positions, including executive directors and personnel officers. Some non-management jobs, including messengers and hotel workers, were also included. Today, Labour Minister Ngor Kolongor issued a statement saying only low-level positions are being targeted. It says, and we quote, "By executive directors, we mean executive secretaries and secretaries," end of quote. And by public relations positions, the circular meant receptionists and other front desk workers, as well as protocol officers. UN agencies, diplomatic missions and organizations that have agreements with the government of South Sudan are excluded from the order, Ngor says in the statement. Mariar says the Labour Minister's circular was misquoted. He says the government is working on laws that will make clear who can be employed in what job, in both the public and private sectors.
There are labour regulations that specify certain jobs for nationals. There are jobs that specify for non-nationals, like in any other country. And those will be later on discussed with these companies.
Louis de Brouwer, the operations director at the EU Commission's Humanitarian Aid and Civil Protection Department, says the EU understands the directive to mean that foreign employers should
pay attention to the local labour market. That is to say that what they ask is when the expertise which is needed is available on the local market, that the employer give preference to the expertise available on the local market. So that's a matter of preference, but that would be by no means mandatory for them.
Humanitarian agencies say the timing of the order is bad, because it comes as millions of people face food shortages unless they receive aid. Laying off workers now and retraining others to take their jobs would be a recipe for disaster, the aid agencies say. But Mariari insists they won't be affected by the decree.
We care for our relations because we are not in isolation. We are not in the alien territory. We are in this world where we have neighbors. We interact. We do things together. We have a lot of countries in this country who are here to assist in humanitarian issues. They are assisting in development issues. They are supposed to stay here comfortably.
The government decree is set to take effect on October 15th. For VOA News, I am Mugume Devs Rwakarinj in Juba.
A South Sudanese economist says the new government directives to expel all foreign workers in the country is implemented, it would negatively impact on the country's economy. VOA fellow Lucy Pony explains.
James Alich Garang, a senior economist with the Juba-based Ebony Center for Strategic Studies, says the move could be detrimental to the economy because South Sudan imports so many goods and services. He says many foreigners working in South Sudan fill vacancies which require special medical or technical experience, the kind of expertise that is often lacking within the South Sudanese population.
If you were to withdraw some of these workers who are paid in dollars, of course, and they inject these dollars into the economy, if they were to withdraw, you would see a negative impact on the foreign exchange market. And that, of course, would go to affect the imports. Because if you have less dollars, it will be too costly to buy dollars to go and buy import. Because South Sudan is an importing nation. We don't produce much.
Garang also says the directive could make the business environment unfavorable for investors who might be inclined to move their operations elsewhere.
If you were to tamper with their profit-making drive, it is a possibility that they may even go to Rwanda, where the business environment is very conducive.
Garang says a decision like this must be carefully thought through. He says even though the government is trying to provide more employment for its citizens, it should think about the long-term consequences of the directive.
The government is not delivering services to its people. And so maybe this is one way it went to it assert itself as an overseer of the economy and a caretaker of its people, such that if the ministry concerned issues the directive the way it has done, that would please some South Sudanese, because they're going to take over this position and run them as they please without worrying about the consequence. If you put it in a global contract, now we are moving toward a position such a way that the talk is now about open border, social mobility, labor mobility, even they talk about joining East Africa Community. This directive might impact it.
This is the third time the government of South Sudan has issued such a directive. Both were issued after the independence of South Sudan in 2011. However, neither of the two previous orders were ever implemented. Both were withdrawn after intense criticism from Ugandans, Kenyans, and even some South Sudanese. For VOA News, I'm Lucy Pony reporting from Washington.
Yesterday, a businessman told us he thinks many South Sudanese do not have the training necessary to hold senior management posts. A group of Americans and former refugees think they could get good jobs if they get a decent education. Our web editor Karen Zaivogo tells us about a project to build school in a Payamin jungle estate and how it has given the villagers a chance to dream of a brighter future.
President Salva Kiir pledged on the day South Sudan became independent in July 2011 to build schools in all 10 states within the first 100 days. That has not happened.
It has been over 100 days. I can say zero has been done about that promise.
That's Michael Kwani. He left South Sudan in 2001 and around 7 years ago went back to his village in Jonglei State and asked the people there what he could do for them. He expected them to ask for food, but they told him,
"Food will finish in one day or two, but if you help us with education, our children will learn and the next generation to come will also learn from that school," which I was surprised because education was not a priority. According to what I knew, from my elders, from my villagers.
Kwani set up an NGO called Rebuild South Sudan and teamed up with a group of Americans to build a school for the people of Jale. One of the Americans is Katie Rivers.
I am the board president of Rebuild South Sudan.
Like the people of Jale, Rivers believes learning can go a long way.
Education is very much seen as a tool to break down the cycle of violence. You can teach kids how to use guns, or you can teach them how to use pencils and how to create and innovate.
Ground was broken in February 2012 on the spot in Jale where the school will one day stand. Everyone in Jale chipped in to help build the school. Little kids carried planks of wood, men hoisted steel beams into the air for the roof. And then fighting broke out in South Sudan last December. As the conflict spread from Juba to Jonglei State, Kwani told the people of Jale to go somewhere safe. But many of them refused to leave their payam.
They didn't want to leave Jale because the school structure was there and that was a source of hope. And they're like, "We don't want to leave this school." And Michael was on the phone being like, "You have to leave. We can't have a school if you're not alive."
Construction of the school was put on hold because of the fighting. When I spoke to Kwani by phone last week, he said he was disappointed, but not defeated.
This school could have been operating right now. But because of this crisis that they actually created, but I'm not giving up. I'm not losing hope. And I strongly believe in education. Education can transform the mind and the heart of the people who had gone through trauma.
So far, only the steel supports of the school are standing. But when construction is finished, the school will include a 5,000-book library, solar lighting, 8 classrooms that can hold 640 students, and a computer lab. Imagine that, a room full of computers in a payam in Jonglei State. The design of the school has won awards in the United States. It's flood-resistant and includes a ventilation system that cools all the classrooms. Rebuild South Sudan wants to build similar schools around South Sudan, but for now, the NGO is waiting for the fighting to stop so that its first construction project, the school in Jale, can be finished. For VOA News, I'm Karen Zeitvogel.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, Tensions continue to rise along the border between Uganda and South Sudan. That story is coming up after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what do you think the best political system is for your country?
The federal system will be the best in my country because there will be decentralization of power. It will be more effective and everybody will be concerned for his region and there will be more structural projects. It's a system that succeeded.
I think the best political system for my country is the democratic system of government, because people will be free to express their minds and the voice of the people will be taken into consideration.
Multi-party system, because it gives room for democracy, it gives room for participation, it gives room for many, many other actors to be involved in politics.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Witnesses say the communal clashes between South Sudanese and Ugandans in Moyo District are getting out of control. The Kejikeji County authorities say around 2,000 South Sudanese have been forced to leave their property in Uganda. The South Sudanese Bishop of Kejikeji Diocese says the number of people affected by the border dispute is expected to increase. Anthony Pogo says women and children are suffering and need help immediately.
I think the origin of this problem goes to the border dispute that has been there, an area bordering Uganda and South Sudan that has been in contention. And so that is what has contributed to the ongoing problem.
We understand this is not the first time these two communities are fighting each other, correct?
It is. However, the difference is that this time it's gone to another different level because it's resulted in two searching of tukus and houses of the South Sudanese people in Moyo, as well as they have been given ultimatum to leave Moyo District.
Can you put us into perspective? We understand Moyo District is in Uganda. How come South Sudanese are living in Moyo District? Are they refugees? Are they, what kind of status are they living under in Moyo District?
We are communities that border each other and we have lived with each other for a very long time. During the time when there was war in Uganda, many of the people came down here as refugees. Even when there was peace in Uganda, some of them stayed on until our own conflict started, and then they all went back. When the peace agreement was signed, many of the South Sudanese people in Moyo came back. Some of them remained. Some of them have running businesses in Moyo town. Some have children who are in school. And because these are communities where there is intermarriage, the relation between the two communities have been cordial until, of course, this time when the issue of the boundary came up.
The people who you were saying that they escaped from Moyo and came to Kejikeji, how many people are we talking about and what is their condition like?
Yesterday, the commissioner who has the details of the number of people who have left gave us a figure of between 2,000 and 5,000. This morning, more people have also been received. In fact, when we call, I'm on my way to the border to see the condition of those who came in today. We estimate that within probably we'll be looking at least 10,000 people who would have crossed, because there are people who have also crossed through some of the areas which are not the official crossing areas because people are desperate to leave, particularly those whose houses were touched. There is definitely an urgent need for shelter, food, and children are getting sick because of sleeping out in the open. And this is, of course, still the rainy season, so it's still cold at night. So that's the situation of the people.
That's Anthony Pogo, the Bishop of Kejikeji Diocese, speaking to me earlier today from Kejikeji Town. Meanwhile, the former Ugandan Minister of Labor, who is in exile in the United States, says the border issue between the two countries is not new. Zoe Bakoko Bakuru says President Salva Kiir and Yoweri Museveni should work to find a permanent solution to the border crisis.
There's a border which is being claimed by the Sudanese as part of their land, and then at the same time, Uganda says it belongs to them. And they should really send surveyors there to go and check this out and demarcate it and resolve the problem. And I don't understand why this problem is continuing. My understanding is that President Salva Kiir and President Museveni had a meeting, and they agreed that the issue was going to be resolved and that no activity, whether from Sudanese side or Ugandan side, should take place in that disputed land until the issue was resolved. If that was the resolution which was made by President Museveni and President Salva Kiir, why should the Uganda government have sent enumerators to go and count people there? And I remember a few months back, there was also a dispute over a market. And so I think it is of utmost importance. And now that the military are getting involved, we have so many wars, we have had so many wars, I don't think there is a need for us to open another corridor of conflict between South Sudan and Uganda, particularly when the UPDF is in Sudan supporting Salva Kiir to fight their internal wars.
Zoe Bakoko Bakuru is the former Ugandan Minister of Labor who hails from Arua District in Uganda. She was speaking with me earlier today from the U.S. East Coast state of New Jersey. South Sudan says it's working to stop counterfeit and out-of-date drugs from coming into the country. Officials open an office of the National Drug and Food Control Authority, or DFCA, in the capital yesterday to lead the fight against the problem. For VOA News, Mungume Debs Rakarinj files this report from Juba.
Health Minister Riek Gaykok says the DFCA needs to have teeth to be able to tackle the problem of bogus drugs and medicines that are past their best before dead.
لأن كلنا بشر بنمرضوا بنحتاج لدواء.
All of us fall sick, and we are subjected to treatment from medicines which are manufactured out of our country. You cannot be sure if it is genuine medicine or not. That is why it is important to do screening before the medicine is allowed to enter into our country. Dr. Peter Agwek-Kokbak, the Director General for Inspection in the Health Ministry, is one of the five officials who run the authority. He says drugs have been entering South Sudan without proper inspection.
The people are bringing medicine like a food. Outside, they're bringing buses, they're bringing load, whatever. From the border, they go to West Equatorian, West Eastern Equatorian, even to go to the north, South Sudan.
But that is going to change, Bak says. Officials will be stationed at every point of entry to the country, and the DFCA will issue certificates to pharmaceutical companies that are authorized to import and sell drugs in South Sudan, he says.
We are trying to get the main gate, like Numuli gates, like Kaya gate. These are the main sources of coming the medicine South Sudan. You cannot do it alone unless other partnerships are helping us, like the police, like also Board of Standard, they can helping us.
Bak says in spite of the government's best efforts to control the problem, there will still be people who try to sneak unauthorized drugs into the country. He says the DFCA will ask customs officers to ensure that all buses coming into South Sudan are checked for bogus medicines. The DFCA faces another problem too. 80% of the South Sudanese population is illiterate, which means they cannot read drug labels or their expiry dates. To get around that problem, Bak says,
we are going to put our logo for each consignment coming to South Sudan.
That will show that the medicine has been checked and approved for import by the DFCA, Bak says. The DFCA was established in 2012 by President Kiir, but has been inactive until now because of lack of funds. For VOA News, I am Mugume Debs Rwakarinj in Juba.
From Juba, we move to Warap. People in Kwajok are welcoming a decision by the state officials to finally repair a 30-kilometer stretch of road linking Warap to neighboring Western Bahr El Ghazal state. Transportation costs are expected to drop once the road is repaired, and commuters and drivers think that having a smooth road will be good for their health. For VOA News, Santino Monut Ayuel reports from Kwajok.
Around a dozen workers are busy trying to fix part of the Kwajok to Terkweng road just outside capital of Warap State. One man uses a grader to level the road. Another operates a steamroller to compact the earth and smooth it, while a third man drives a tipper truck loaded with a mix of gravel and mara. Joseph Godkirtong is the acting director of roads and bridges in Waraba State's infrastructure ministry.
We are maintaining the road with the company of Ayat, who are helping us to maintain this road, say that to deliver services to the community. This road is very important because it is connecting the two states.
Mayor Deng Mayor is Waraba State Physical Infrastructure Minister.
We decided to upgrade this road because it's badly damaged. It's about 30 kilometers and it costs us something to do with 500,000 South Sudanese pounds from Kwajok to Tarkwang. After the completion, they will come and start from Kwajok here also to Twitch County.
A yard construction company is offering its equipment to the state government free of charge to repair the road. Mayar says the state government will contribute funds to the project to buy fuel for the machinery and trucks needed to fix the road and to pay the workers.
We are relieved and happy because the state this road is in, it will stop us from having children or it gives us hemorrhoids. And when your vehicle gets stuck in the mud, nobody pulls you out. So we are so thankful to the government of Waraba State for taking the initiative to fix the road.
The repair work is expected to last several weeks. At least once it is done, bus fares between Kwajok and Wau are likely to come down. Kwajok resident James Galamalim is also happy that the road is finally getting fixed.
I hope if the government of Waraba State coordinate with the government of national, instead of reviewing every year to pay a lot of money, we should have to start with the tarmac. A few days back, we have seen the road from here to Wau was very bad. Even sometime it will take 4 hours, 5 hours.
South Sudan has only around 300 kilometers of paved roads. A third of those are in the capital, Juba, and there is a 192-kilometer tarmac road linking Juba to the Uganda border. Minister Mayar says Waraba State government plans to repair all the major roadways across the state to ease the movement of people and goods, but he did not mention any plans to start paving roads. For BOA News, I am Santino Manut Ayuel in Kwajok, Waraba State.
That report by Santino Manut brings us to the end of our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song We Want Peace by rap superstar Emmanuel Jal.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, I'm looking for some people who's looking for peace. Maybe together we could make the war cease. Now we can send mankind to the moon. And we can reach to the bottom of the sea. That's why it really kind of baffles me that we cannot end wars and bring peace. And we cannot change the way people act. And we cannot change the way people think. So if we sit back, chill out and relax, civilization will soon be extinct. That's why I am. I'm calling on the whole wide world. Come on people, would you help me? Cause we want peace. To say the least, I dedicate this song to the common people caught in the middle of this common evil. I wish the world was a little bit better. Time to start looking at the man in the mirror. Fear is the devil's policeman. Fear make good genocide with Hitler so he can feel a war of genocide and hope was weakened. Lighting up the land cause nobody was speaking. That's why I am. I'm calling on the whole wide world. Come on people, would you help me? Let's scream and shout, cause we want peace. To say the least, somebody said after Rwanda. And after Rwanda, and not far from Rwanda, who's gonna shout for the poor people living in Darfur? The world gone deaf.
We have been listening to South Sudanese artist Emmanuel Jal and the song We Want Peace. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
One more time, we got no more time.